You're listening to episode 14 of the National Centre for Writing podcast with me, Simon Jones. Every week we talk to writers and creatives about their techniques and exciting new projects. This is a very special episode featuring the return of none other than Val McDermott. Val delivered the annual lecture at the Noirage Crime Writing Festival earlier this month on the subject of what we really talk about when we talk about crime fiction. And we have the full speech on the podcast for you today. The Noirage Lecture is presented by The Times and Sunday Times Crime Club, and the Noirage Festival is a partnership between us and the University of East Anglia. As well as being a legendary crime author, Val is also one of this year's Man Booker Prize judges, and her lecture examines where crime fiction sits in the wider literature scene, and how it relates to society and the real world. Whether you're a crime fiction reader or not, you'll find this a fascinating listen. So I'm going to stop talking and hand you over to Val McDermott.
The subject of my lecture tonight is what we really talk about when we talk about crime fiction. If you only paid attention to the media, both social and antisocial, you'd think that crime fiction was concerned almost exclusively with violence, particularly violence against women. You'd imagine that me and my colleagues spend our days figuring out the most hideously gruesome things that one human being can do to another and revel in the production of cheap thrills. And yet that's so far from the truth. I don't think that crime fiction is actually about murder at all. It's my contention that the readers of crime fiction form a segment of the population that are the best informed and most engaged with the world around them, because the books they read consistently explore contemporary issues and constantly challenge their views. We shift people out of their comfort zones and make them squirm, but not because we kill people. I firmly believe you can't read the best of crime fiction and not question yourself, much as the detective questions her suspects. Because really, as I said, these books are not about murder at all. That might sound odd, perverse even, given that almost all crime fiction features sudden violent death, or more subtle forms of homicide. The bottom line either way is at least one person generally ends up dead. There are a few notable exceptions, but it's impossible to discuss them without spoilers, which would be a very different provocation in a room containing so many people who know interesting and undetectable ways to kill me. But the reality is that crime writers are not now, nor have they ever been, solely interested in probing the nature of murder and its motivations. I'd argue that it's often the last thing on our minds when we sit down to write our novels. Of course, the murder, or murders, provide the frisson of excitement. Sudden violent death does tend to raise the adrenaline levels of even the most hardened reader of the genre. But that's just the lure we use to draw you in. So what are we really talking about when we talk about crime fiction? We're talking about the things that matter to us as human beings. We're talking about class, about politics, about gender, about place, about the human psyche, about race, about justice, about love, about sex, about economics, about history, about inequalities of all sorts. And what this genre does at its best is illuminate us to ourselves. Crime fiction is what we turn to when we want to understand how we live now and also how we lived then. When detective novels first found popularity, the murders mostly happened off stage. There was scarcely a trace of blood except as a clue. Racha scrawled on the wall in blood in A Study in Scarlet. Agatha Christie's apparently supernatural tale of the pavement whose bloodstains foretold death. And Dorothy L. Sayers' meandering muddle, Have His Carcass, which features the discovery of a body surrounded by copious but ultimately misleading quantities of blood. But murder was more or less incidental to those stories. People who had lived through a succession of bloody conflicts culminating in the First World War had little appetite for depictions and descriptions of violence and horror. What they were after was the puzzle that engaged the little grey cells. I don't think it's any coincidence that the rise of the Golden Age mystery story ran parallel to the development of the crossword puzzle. The first known crossword puzzle appeared in December 1913 in a Sunday paper, the New York World, and for the trivia buffs among you, the newspaper after which the World Series in baseball is named. The idea caught on, and by the early 1920s it had gained a foothold in the UK. In 1924 the Daily Express had begun to feature them, And by 1930, the year of The Murder at the Vicarage, the first Miss Marple novel, the Times had picked it up. The new style of cryptic crossword quickly gained ardent fans, hand in hand with the flowering of the classic detective mystery on both sides of the Atlantic. At a time when the old certainties had crumbled and the Depression had threatened the very pillars of society, people craved answers. The puzzle offered the balm of solutions, albeit on a relatively trivial scale, but sometimes that's all we need to keep us hanging on. So those Golden Age novels were already showing that the detective novel wasn't really about murder. And since then, thousands of crime writers have been beating the crime novel like a piñata and falling eagerly on what spills out on the floor when it shatters. It's been a long time since the crime novel burst the banks of the narrow puzzle and flowed out to cover a multitude of concerns. Let's look at some of the issues I mentioned earlier. Take gender and sexuality. From the very dawn of crime fiction, writers have taken an interest in what we'd now call gender fluidity. Back in 1886, the year before Sherlock Holmes first appeared in print, a young baron called Britiff Scotto, who had taken a first at Oxford, published a novel called Sudden Death or My Lady the Wolf. The narrator witnesses a mysterious woman committing a murder on a clifftop. Now, I suspect that none of you are actually going to track down and read this rather bizarre and very obscure book, so there will now be spoilers. Soon after witnessing the crime, the narrator becomes friends with Gordon Lee, a dashing and charismatic young man. Two more murders follow, including that of the narrator's fiancée. The suspect emerges as Astarte, a woman described as the most reckless, heartless, cruel daredevil that ever walked on the earth. In the final chapter, Astarte is unveiled as Gordon Lee's alter ego. She admits to living sometimes as a man, sometimes as a woman, but more often as the former because I liked it better. She admits that she killed out of love for the narrator and commits suicide with poison. You may be surprised to hear that it didn't start a trend. In fact, we have to wait quite a long time for any serious exploration of gender and sexuality. Of course, there are the occasional effete confirmed bachelors and mannish spinsters who turn up from time to time in the Golden Age novels. Daring to suggest the love that dare not speak its name, there's the fatal obsession of Clotilde Bradbury Scott for Verity Hunt in Agatha Christie's Nemesis, a frustrated lesbian desire if ever there was one. But none of this counts as anything other than a profoundly muted acknowledgement of something never spoken of in polite society. The first writer to incorporate questions of gender and sexuality into her work was Josephine Tay. Questions of identity permeate her work, and although she never explicitly deals with sexuality, it's often an obvious subtext. Brat Farrar hinges on whether a young man is truly who he purports to be. The Franchise Affair turns on whether a mother and daughter have a secret life that verges on the perverse. Miss Pym Disposes is only a mystery because issues of sexuality were so deeply submerged in that time and place that they were unthinkable as part of the solution to a crime. To Love and Be Wise is entirely shaped by fixed notions of gender. Masks and the identities they hide run through her work like the unifying thread in a tapestry. Her detective, Scotland Yard Inspector Alan Grant, is portrayed with, I contend, a degree of sexual ambiguity found nowhere else in the crime fiction of the period. In The Singing Sands, Tay's final novel, she provides Grant with the first serious love interest in the series. Grant has escaped from London to fish on his cousin's estate in Scotland. He has barely arrived when Zoe, Lady Kentallan, a widowed mother of three sons, also pitches up for a visit. Here is how Tay describes her through Grant's eyes. She was more like an adolescent boy than a prospective dowager. She was wearing very elegant trousers and a disreputable old lumberjacket, and he remarked that she was one of the few women who looked really well in trousers. One magical afternoon's fishing later, Grant is contemplating the possibility of marriage to this androgynous woman. But what proves far more seductive is his previous encounter with a dead man on the Caledonian Sleeper, the dead man with the tumbled black hair and the reckless eyebrows. Finding the key to unlock this mysterious death obsesses Grant to the point where he comes to his senses and realises the idea of marrying Zoe Kentallan is ridiculous. It's an extreme reaction. Most single men faced with the prospect of a ravishingly attractive widow who shares their background and interests would, at the very least, pursue the possibility of a relationship, not Grant. And this is of a piece with the way that Tay deals with gender and sexuality in her work. I think Tay's work offered fresh possibilities for those who could read between the lines. She opened doors for the likes of Ruth Rendell and Patricia Highsmith, both of whom offered unusual approaches to gender and sexuality at a time when such matters were largely ignored in mainstream fiction. Things had changed by the 1980s. Hiding behind the pseudonym of Dan Kavanagh, Booker Prize winner Julian Barnes wrote four crime novels whose rackety backdrop was light years away from the metroland of the rest of his output. He once described writing these books as liberating, and his bisexual protagonist Duffy is definitely liberated. At the same time as Barnes' detective was exploring a more fluid sexuality, women on the other side of the Atlantic were also writing sleuths who were making very different choices when it came to who they slept with. The difference here, however, was that the lesbian crime fiction that surfed the new wave created by writers such as Marcia Muller, Sue Grafton and Sarah Paretsky didn't just happen to have gay characters. These writers also embraced sexual politics. I can still remember the delight I felt when I first encountered the likes of Catherine V. Forrest, Barbara Wilson and Mary Wings. They were writing crime fiction that was jam-packed with lesbians. For the first time in my reading experience, I saw lives that mirrored such an important aspect of my own. Reading those books led me to the understanding that I didn't have to hide my own life when I wrote my fictions. They liberated me to create Lindsay Gordon, the first British lesbian detective, well, the first openly lesbian detective, British. I wasn't alone for long. Soon I was joined by the likes of Stella Duffy, Manda Scott, and several others. For us, the story came first, but the gender politics were always wrapped up in the package too. Incidentally, I've often been asked why there was this sudden outburst of feminist crime fiction on both sides of the Atlantic. The only theory I have is that we were all working so hard at raising our consciousness and fighting the patriarchy that we were desperate for some fun at the end of the day. And as I've already pointed out, the crime novel is a space where we can talk about all sorts of things under the umbrella of murder. These days, when gender fluidity is part of the conversation, it's not unremarkable to find characters in the genre who embrace a more fluid sexuality. For example, Kristen Lipionka's alt-private eye, Roxanne Weary, is far less interested in the gender of who she sleeps with than in their personality. It's never an issue, barely a question, which is increasingly perceived as how things should be. Trust me, it's a generational thing. George Orwell wrote, "If you look for the working classes in fiction, and especially English fiction, all you will find is a hole." That's a fairly accurate summation of the way class is portrayed in the Golden Age detective novel and beyond. I suspect the main reason for the invisibility of the working classes was that they weren't writers. Nobody was giving them £500 a year in a room of their own. For middle-class writers, the working class experience could only be guessed at, so they were best left alone to muddle through in assorted feckless poor roles. Or if they were really lucky, maids, gardeners and butlers, who incidentally almost never did it because of course, Golden Age writers stuck to the rules. The American writer S.S. Van Dien promulgated 20 rules for writing detective fiction, of which number 11 read, "A servant must not be chosen as the culprit. The culprit must be a decidedly worthwhile person, one that wouldn't normally come under suspicion. Unlike those dreadful low-life servants, only a pay packet away from villainy." Probably the main drivers of a shift in the way novels deal with class were the educational reforms of the first half of the 20th century. The Education Act of 1944 raised the school leaving age in England and Wales to 14, only lagging 43 years behind Scotland in that respect. And also made it possible for working-class children to receive an education they'd previously not been able to afford. For example, neither of my own parents, born in the 1920s, was able to attend the high school whose entrance exam they'd passed because their parents couldn't afford the uniform. That's not a pity-me story, by the way. They always shrugged it off as just the way of the world, an educational outcome all too common in the mining communities where they were raised. Education was the key that unlocked the door for a different sort of writer. Working class boys, and they were almost all boys with a few notable exceptions like Sheila Delaney, such as Stan Barstow, Alan Sillitoe, William McIlvany and David Storey, found their voices in the late 50s and early 60s and found publishers willing to take a chance on these distinctive and fresh novels that quickly found an audience. The readers who shared their backgrounds rejoiced to see their world on the page. The middle classes were intrigued by these exotic creatures whose interior lives they'd known so little about. One of the first crime writers to take a tentative step into this world was Ruth Rendell. With her Wexford series, she reflected the way the social fabric was being turned into a thing of shreds and patches. Although her debut novel is still set primarily among the middle classes, it's clear from the outset that while Chief Inspector Reg Wexford is an intelligent and perceptive man, in social terms, he's light years away from Peter Whimsy. I've said it before, and doubtless I will say it again, that Peter Whimsy has a face you'd never tire of slapping. Although she later became a much more assured anatomist of class, Rendell's early excursions into the lower echelons were welcome but tentative. Nothing there to frighten the horses. It was a start, but there were still miles to go. The book that many regard as the one that blew the bloody doors off was Jack's Return Home by Ted Lewis, adapted for cinema as the iconic Michael Caine vehicle Get Carter. Lewis's world was far less genteel and much more uncompromising than the mean streets of King's Markham. Set in the northeast, the story starts with the murder of Jack Carter's brother, then takes us on a tour of lowlife that reeks with verisimilitude. Massage parlours, bingo halls, teenage pornography and organised petty crime all parade through the pages. Never mind the blatant races, the horses were not so much frightened as galloping in terror down the Scotty Road. Suddenly, it became not just possible, but appealing to write about working class lives. It took the best part of a decade, but when William McIlvany took his scalpel to the people at the bottom of the heap in Glasgow, he started a whole movement. Until his 1977 novel Laidlaw, there had been no Scottish tradition of crime fiction. Single-handedly, McIlvany laid the foundations of what has become a vigorous subgenre of its own, tartan noir. Before Laidlaw, I had never read any novel, never mind a crime novel, where the characters spoke in the voices I heard every day in the streets and pubs of Glasgow. McIlvany demonstrated a possibility, and where he led, others followed, breaking the home county's middle-class mould forever. John Harvey's Nottingham, Ian Rankin's Edinburgh, Mark Timlin's working-class London, my own Manchester, became the settings for crime novels that felt more authentic than cosy police procedurals and village mysteries. Writers such as Denise Miner gave voices to the sort of characters who were previously unheard and unseen. Her first protagonist, Maureen O'Donnell, is from a chaotic working-class background. She has a history of mental health issues, so is automatically perceived as an unreliable narrator. Miner lifts the lid on another world, and her view remains compassionate and uncompromising. This new wave of crime fiction recognised that because we're writing about breaking the law, we have an entree into the subculture of organised and disorganised crime. We can range over white-collar and blue-collar villainy. Academic and specialist in crime fiction Andrew Pepper has written, "Inevitably, the growth in the genre's popularity over the last 20 years has seen a corresponding increase in the number of non-white, unstraight, female crime writers and, of course, readers, a reflection of changing social demographics and habits and an acknowledgement of important shifts in the social status of women, gays, lesbians and ethnic minorities." Now, I believe the crime novel is a three-legged stool: character, story and location. Whether it's Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles or Ellie Griffith's Norfolk, Andrea Camilleri's Sicily or Jane Harper's Australian Bush, crime writers often use a sense of place as a crucial part of their storytelling. I'll let you into a little secret here. It's one of the ways we trick our readers into suspending their disbelief. Everybody knows that murders aren't solved the way we write them. It's never Detective Inspector Grumpy and his sidekick who buys the drinks who unmask the murderer in real life. Murders are solved by tedious, repetitive interviews, studying CCTV footage, and making sense of forensic results which are not always as decisive as we'd like to think. But that wouldn't make for a very interesting read. So we go off on a flight of fancy, and one of the ways we give that a flavour of authenticity is by locating the story in a firmly recognisable place. It's much easier to get the reader to accompany us down these mean streets if we get the ambience right. We have to make it resonate with people who know the setting, but we also have to create an atmosphere that echoes with the experiences of our readers. They might never have been in the Swedish elk forest that Tuva Moodysson inhabits in Will Dean's Dark Pines, or the hectic, overpopulated heat of 1920s Calcutta, as described by Abir Mukherjee. But we have to be able to believe in those places so our imagination can build a backdrop that convinces us we're in a real place. It doesn't have to be real. My own Bradfield is a fictitious northern city, but it has to feel real. And these days, we're just as likely to choose a crime novel set in our holiday destination as we are to read a travel guide. For the novel will give us what the travel guide will not, a flavour of the lives of the people who belong there, a window on aspects of culture and politics that we won't get anywhere else. Not to mention the occasional useful tip on where to eat and drink, and where to avoid after dark, or indeed in the middle of the day. Tourist boards like us too. The crime fiction city tour has become a thing. In Gaborone, you can follow the footsteps of Mara Motswe of the number one ladies detective agency. In Edinburgh, you can do the Rebus tour. And in Sweden, you can choose between the Millennium Trilogy tour in Stockholm or the less cheerful Kurt Wallander tour of Istad. And I know from my own experience that many readers construct their own tours based on their favourite books and authors. I used regularly to get emails from readers disgruntled that they couldn't find Kate Branigan's house in Manchester. Duh, it's because it doesn't exist. So even though we write about the darkness, it really doesn't put people off. Mind you, I come from a country where the tourist advertising does sound like a threat. Visit Scotland. It's not just geography that we learn about when we immerse ourselves in crime fiction, though. Delving into the past has given writers another canvas to work on, often with remarkably illuminating results. Among the first was Josephine Tay, again. In 1951, she published The Daughter of Time. In 1990, it topped the poll of the best ever crime novel voted on by the Crime Writers Association members. 5 years later, it came fourth in a similar poll of the Mystery Writers of America. Quite a pair of accolades for a novel whose detective never leaves his hospital bed. Although The Daughter of Time has a contemporary setting, it's a forensic examination of the case against Richard III and his alleged murder of the princes in the Tower. It's also a penetrating and often disparaging analysis of how history comes to be written by the victors and the survivors. For the general reader, it's a fascinating education in critical thinking. And at its best, that's what history mysteries do. They help us to take a second look at periods and characters we either don't know at all, or about which we have misapprehensions and misunderstandings. Maybe without Josephine Tay, there wouldn't have been quite so much rejoicing when they found Richard III under a Leicester car park. Though she wasn't the first to set her crimes in the past, Ellis Peters' Brother Cadfael mysteries were the ones that found a wide readership and opened the historical floodgates. Their medieval world feels quite sanitised to me, and Cadfael's moral attitudes do sometimes seem anachronistic, but they did generate an appetite that was soon confronted with a very different historical dish. Critic and philosopher Umberto Eco provided a unique take on the medieval monastic murder mystery with The Name of the Rose. It was a demanding read, drawing on semiotics and literary theory, but still proving hugely popular, especially after a film adaptation starring Sean Connery. The historical element, it seemed, could make the crime novel intellectually respectable. Who knew? Lindsay Davis's Roman mysteries followed in the 1990s, and their depiction of the Roman Empire made its inhabitants instantly recognisable as human beings in their rich variety. Across the Atlantic, the history mystery was also establishing a toehold, and all at once it seemed there was an explosion of historical detectives, their numbers growing exponentially, covering the entirety of human history from biblical times to a week past Tuesday. There are crime novels that take us into Stalin's Russia, medieval Irish convents, Nazi Germany, 17th century Scotland, Elizabethan spy networks, an 18th century debtor's prison, the dying years of the Raj, the Great Fire of London, and the hunt for the Yorkshire Ripper. Aspects of our history, about which we had little knowledge and less understanding, are explained to us more palatably than any school history lesson. And some of the best prose stylists in the genre choose the past as their canvas. Andrew Taylor's absorbing novels range over the centuries, from the 17th to the mid-1950s. Ellie Griffiths and Sarah Sheridan both used 1950s Brighton as their backdrop. Ian Payers wrote a post-restoration novel whose background is the emergence of the scientific method and its collision with more ancient philosophies. Denise Minor and Liam McIlvany have both recently written novels set in Glasgow in the 1950s and 1960s, which draw heavily on real cases, each approaching history in a distinctive and individual way. You can't read any of these books and not understand more about the world. History, it is said, is written by the victors. But it seems to me that often historical crime fiction is written by the losers, or at the very least, the bit players. And those sideways glances at events we thought we knew about give us pause for thought. The underdog's view is, of course, as partial as anyone else's, but it's a different partiality, and it prods us into reconsidering the received wisdom we've absorbed over the years. Going back to Andrew Taylor again, for example, in The Ashes of London and The Fire Court, he's writing about what lies beneath the thing we think we all know about, the Great Fire of London. We see that as an all-engulfing phenomenon. Our history lessons elevate it to the only thing of note happening in 1666. But Andrew Taylor's books remind us that even in times of catastrophe, other significant things happen. Lives go on beneath and below the headlines, and that's often where the most interesting stories lie. Just because the city was burning, it didn't mean that everything else came to a standstill. Negotiating great events and unpicking what was going on alongside them is a task perfectly suited to the writer of fiction. Because, as Ali Smith says, fiction and lies are the opposite of each other. Fiction is one of our ways to get to truths that are really difficult to talk about, that we haven't yet been able to articulate or see yet, the truths that we come to articulate via a story. And truly, the murders don't matter that much in any of these novels. They're all astonishingly good stories, packed with memorable characters and vivid settings. The past might be another country, but it's one that has very obvious connections to our present. And one way to explore that connectivity is through cold case investigations. I've used this myself with my Scottish detective, Karen Pirrie, who runs the Historic Cases Unit of Police Scotland. It's an entity that doesn't exist in reality, which gives me even more of a free hand in imagining the parameters of Karen's job. She first appeared in 2003 when she played a minor but crucial role in The Distant Echo, a contemporary case with its roots in a 25-year-old murder. A few years later, I finally managed to pull together a story that would allow me to write about the miners' strike of 1984. I had covered this story in the north of England when I was a journalist, but because I'd grown up in the Fife coalfield, I understood the social implications and the consequences as well as the political ones. I had known when I was writing about the strike and its impact on those communities that if I ever succeeded in becoming a writer of fiction, one day I would want to write about the profound and lingering effects of that year of industrial action, a tragic year of lions led by donkeys. And I also understood at first hand what happened to a pit village when it lost its reason for existence, because the mine in my grandparents' village had been closed down in 1967 after an underground explosion in which 9 men died. I'd watched the slow withering of village life and the unsurvivable damage to community that had followed. It didn't exactly die. It has a new existence these days as a dormitory community. But what happened left its scars on me. And so often we end up writing about what has scarred us. So when I came to write A Darker Domain, I already had an off-the-shelf cold case detective in Fife, which saved me the bother of having to make one up. Quite lazy, really. Through Karen Pirrie's investigation and her eyes, I could look at the past through the lens of the present and draw conclusions about what had changed or remained the same. The most interesting thing that emerged for me when I talked to audiences in the south of England about this book is that they were astonished at the privations the mining families had gone through and the loss of civil liberties in the coalfields during the strike. What for me had been unavoidable knowledge had simply flowed over them because the mainstream media had reported so little and so partially. Some people even thought I was making it up for effect. There are many things I make up, but the effects on the ground of the miners' strike are not among them. Karen's next appearance was rooted not in what had scarred me, but what had made its mark on my friends. Professor Dame Sue Black is the UK's leading forensic anthropologist, and she was the lead anthro investigator for the International Criminal Court's inquiry into human rights violations in Kosovo in the 1990s. And Cathy Wilkes was a philosophy don at my alma mater, St Hilda's College in Oxford. Cathy's commitment to free speech and the right of access to philosophical thought took her to the Inter-University Centre in Dubrovnik. It was, I believe, the only institution where academics from both sides of the Iron Curtain could meet. But in 1991, war broke out in the fractured Balkans and Dubrovnik came under siege. Cathy stayed there throughout, even though there were times when she could probably have fled. Both Sue and Cathy shared their horror stories with me over the years, and I was determined that those stories not be lost. It's amazing how quickly we forget recent history, even that which contains episodes far more profoundly horrific than anything we crime writers can imagine. And this reminds me that the crime novel also allows us to explore ideas of ethics and morality. Books like Dan Fesperman's Lie in the Dark, set during the Siege of Sarajevo, or Laura Wilson's Stratton's War, set in London during the Blitz, ask us to confront the significance of each single life. Even in a time of war or everyday carnage, murder should not go unpunished. One last word about Karen Piri, her latest outing, Broken Ground, pause for commercial break, available from all good booksellers and the one outside, was inspired by my being reminded that during the Second World War, the far north of Scotland was a restricted area. Nobody was allowed north of the Great Glen, between Fort William and Inverness, that is, without an official permit. And if you happened to live in that area, you couldn't travel more than 20 miles from your residence without authorisation from the local military command. Can you imagine what that was like? In this country, we were supposedly fighting for freedom. There were reasons for this, of course, although the details have only been released relatively recently. Commandos were trained here. Special operations executive agents who would be sent behind enemy lines were trained here. The Russian convoys that braved the U-boat-ridden North Atlantic to get food to our Soviet allies were based here. And Loch Hue was where our submarines came to be refueled and resupplied. Hunting lodges and castles were requisitioned, and local life was often seriously disrupted. I knew nothing of this until very recently, and it was too tempting to ignore. So an incident that, in 1944, that I heard about at third hand from a bookseller, became the trigger point for a novel that's mostly set in the here and now, but also in 1995, as well as the wartime years. Pay attention at the back, it's less complicated than it sounds. Thinking about the way we write about history has reminded me that it's not always possible to write about place and time without also taking on politics. There's no doubt that whatsoever the crime novel never shies away from politics in its many and varied forms. Incidentally, one I've noticed over the years is that books are only ever criticised for being political when they challenge the status quo. We're only chastised for being too political when we question the injustices we see around us. But the truth is that the crime novel is very good at highlighting the notion that the individual crimes our books address are set within a wider set of societal crimes. That was one of the most powerful takeaways I got from Sarah Paretsky's first V.I. Warshawski novel, a book that for me was a complete game changer because of its sexual politics as well as its wider political sensibility. Throughout her body of work, we're presented with a series of crimes that are not just randomly bolted onto her detective's world. They're organic. They happen because of the kind of place Chicago is, its political machine, its sources of employment, its social structures, even its sport. What Paretsky reports back to us is not just the crime of an evil individual. Their activities are set against the wider crimes of poverty, racism, corporate exploitation and corruption at every level. That juxtaposition of different sorts of crime and the different sorts of justice that we see meted out is often what drives a good crime novel. I love that politics infests contemporary crime fiction. Sometimes it's historical. Abir Mukherjee explores the politics of pre-independence India from a variety of angles, showing the stresses and strains that result when ideologies collide. And it's all the more fascinating because we know the outcome. Eva Dolan has chosen to write about immigration and poverty, looking at communities not so far from here. She tackles difficult subjects head-on and doesn't provide easy answers. But because she wraps all this up in a fast-paced, engaging piece of crime fiction, it never feels like polemic. And when we do want to descend into polemic, we can always put the words in the mouths or the heads of our characters. Here's one of the three protagonists in Mick Herron's recent This Is What Happened. The drip, drip, drip of sour resentment was too much the picture of modern Britain to be laughable for long. Since Brexit, the nation's self-bestowed reputation for warmth and tolerance had taken a hammering. The British were insular by definition, and if outright hostility to strangers had been kept in check by a reluctance to appear rude, a narrowly won referendum fought on a campaign fuelled by lies made it all right now to tell ethnic minorities to fuck off home. The inevitable splashback spattered women, gay people, everybody. There'd been a vote, and the nastiness unleashed had not yet gone back in its box. From now on, there would be this unwanted knowledge that when things got down to the wire, the British didn't really have much time for anybody else. By a slim majority, true, but they were the ones in charge. Not murder, then, just murderous rage from one of Mick Herron's characters, not necessarily Mick Herron. I can't let you go without touching on one of the more significant things that drives our fiction. I'm talking about the power of love. Don't worry, I'm not going to break into song. I need to preserve my voice. We've got two fun-loving crime writers' gigs next week. But seriously, love in all its many splendid forms is often at the heart of our novels. It's a motive for murder. It's a motive for detection. It transforms us, and not always for the better. Just look how marriage knocks the ginger out of both Harriet Vane and Lord Peter Wimsey. It distorts and contorts human behaviour. It derails our lives. But it's also capable of providing the most uplifting moments in fiction, as in life. And not just romantic love. Love for our children, our parents, our siblings, our friends, even our cats. It's said that we can't live without love. One thing's for sure, we can't murder without it. So, these are a few of my favourite things that we really talk about when we talk about crime fiction. Murder, violence, they're just the carnival barker's pitch to get you inside the tent. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please do subscribe, rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you happen to be listening. To find out more about the Noirage Crime Writing Festival, head to noirage.co.uk or at noiragefest on Twitter. That's N-O-I-R-W-I-C-H. You can find out about all our upcoming events and current opportunities for writers over at nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk. We've just restarted our tours of Dragon Hall, so if you're visiting the Norwich area, do check the What's On calendar for a free exploration of our remarkable 15th century Merchant Hall HQ. If you want to keep up to date with what we're up to, the best idea is to sign up to our newsletter, which you can do over on the website, or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Writers Centre, and find our page over on Facebook. Next week, we're starting a new mini-series that introduces the world of literary translation. Subscribe to make sure you don't miss it, and I will catch you on the next episode.